ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I'm taking my phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Ngunnawal country here in Parliament House in beautiful Canberra.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney, wishing I was there with you, PK, in Parliament House. What's the sense of things on the ground, I'm wondering, because as we record this, the Treasurer is in the House of Reps introducing the new tax bills and his message was pretty unapologetic. He reckons this is a budget for workers, for first home buyers and for future generations.
Yeah, I mean, he would say that and that's he's very passionate about these changes. He knows he has to fight for them and argue for them. But it's not all just roses and happy times in the Parliament this week. There has been some dissent. We all know that. It's also inside the Labor Party. I mean, some people have been raising concerns about the extent of these changes. So we're going to get into that in a moment. Just on some other issues, a group of so-called ISIS brides have landed in Australia this week as well. I think the optics are very troubling, problematic for the government. It very much plays into One Nation's hands, I think, Fran. And there's also news of a potential teal-ish party, or maybe not. It was briefly touted this week, but it looks like it is over again before it really even began.
It burnt bright for a minute and then fell to earth. That's what it looked like from where I was watching anyway. Yeah, so there's not much happening this week, PK, just kidding. Michelle Grattan's going to be joining us. She's the perfect guest for this week. Shall we bring her in?
Let's do it. Michelle Grattan, Chief Political Correspondent at The Conversation and Professorial Fellow at the University of Canberra. Welcome to The Party Room.
Hi to you both.
Hey, Michelle, great to have you on this day in particular. As I mentioned there, the budget cell has really reached crunch point now. And as we're recording this, the Treasurer's just been on his feet in the House of Representatives.
This is the first step in the most ambitious tax reform package for a quarter of a century. It will help ensure that aspiration and opportunity are the birthright of every Australian and not just some. This bill delivers on three objectives. It cuts taxes for every Australian worker again and again. Yeah. It makes it easier for people to buy their first home, and it better aligns the tax treatment of labour income and asset income.
The opposition is all geared up to say no. It's accusing the government of rushing now and fixing it later. And given the import of these bills, you know, that's a pretty big criticism, I think. What do you think, Michelle? Is this an unholy rush or business as usual for budget tax bills, as the government is saying? And has the government laid the groundwork in the parliament and outside of it to get it through?
I think it is really business as usual, because what's happening is that the legislation is now adjourned until next week. It'll then be considered by the House and by the Senate. The government hopes to have it through by the time the Parliament rises at the end of next week. And then in subsequent weeks, it would bring forward tranches of fresh legislation containing whatever amendments and carve-outs are negotiated with the business sector, the small business sector in particular. So, yes, it's a rush, but in another sense, no, it's not such a rush, because those consultations are going to be going on. As for the opposition, well, of course, it can put forward its objections, it can stamp its feet politically, but if you don't have the numbers, as John Howard used to say, it's the arithmetic that counts.
Yeah, the arithmetic is quite key, and the government clearly has the arithmetic, at least in the lower house. And let's be honest, I think it's very unlikely the Greens will oppose this. I think we agree on that, right?
Well, there's a bit of foot stamping from the Greens too, but in the end, they're not going to vote against these changes, and that's certainly the government's calculation.
I think it's an accurate one. So the government has given this week a bit of a red hot go to kind of resetting the tax changes, bringing it back to what it wants us to focus on, which is housing. It's we're recording this Thursday, as we do with the Party Room. Claire O'Neill will be delivering a speech at the National Press Club. My understanding was that was kind of organised at the last minute with the Press Club.
She's the housing minister.
Yeah, that's what, you know, like they are just wanting to pivot to housing as much as they can. So they're really spinning every part as they can on the kind of benefit to housing, but the carve-outs are still the question overwhelmingly that's being asked of the Prime Minister, how wide the carve-outs will be. I feel like the message we got from the Treasurer, Michelle, is maybe there's a lot of nuance here, but he's wanting more limited carve-outs than I think maybe the Prime Minister was signalling he was open to.
Treasury are going about consulting, not just in tech, but consulting COSBOA, for example, ACCI, the Tech Council. There'll be a policy position paper for consultation produced as well after the first round of consultations that was all foreshadowed there on budget night.
There are legitimate issues when it comes to startups. There's a legitimate conversation going on with the small business sector, for example. But it's important that we apply this change broadly so that we don't introduce another layer of distortions.
The Treasurer will want to limit the carve-outs as much as he can. And, of course, it will, I guess, in the end, be the Prime Minister's call. And, of course, the negotiations are still going on. So we don't know yet where all this exactly will land. But the Treasurer's argument would be that the more you carve out, the more you distort the whole purpose of the legislation.
Mm. Michelle, the government might have the numbers. As you say, the arithmetic works its way in the House, in the Parliament probably, if the Greens end up playing ball. But it doesn't seem to have the numbers, certainly not the loud, noisy numbers anyway, outside the Parliament still. I mean, so far every business group that I can think of, small and large, is critical of the breadth of the changes, though there is some support from COSBOA, the Small Business Agency. But ACCI, the Business Council, they've come out firmly against the scope of these changes and want the government to limit it to housing. And I noted these comments from Paul Bassett, who's, you know, quite an influential venture capitalist. He founded SEEK. He runs the Amplify Public Policy Institute. He says the 50% discount should be retained for non-housing assets so that it should only be there for the housing changes. And he said this, which I thought was interesting. He said, two elements of this budget were surprising. First, they've implemented significant tax changes that have obvious immediate losers and no winners. And second, they do something so fundamental in a really short period of time and without any outside consultation, which goes to this idea of why doesn't the government allow an inquiry on this, Michelle, a long, decent, in-depth inquiry to inform the changes it is clearly considering making?
It's always possible, of course, that there'll be a Senate inquiry depending on how the upper house numbers go and the players react. But in terms of a wider inquiry, I think that the government would judge that would just multiply its problems. I do think it's interesting that the government, which prides itself on being very nimble on its feet in terms of the politics of selling measures and so on, has in this case really been somewhat blindsided by the fact that others have been more nimble, particularly the younger business tech sector. And of course, those memes that we saw were so effective, and the government has found itself outplayed, I think, in this debate, especially because much of the debate has been driven on social media. And that's been different, I think, than budgets we've seen in the past.
Mm. But two things, Michelle, not just nimble on its feet, but it's a Prime Minister who prides himself on and has promised the Australian government and largely delivered, you know, orderly process. And yet, you know, to me, I think, and maybe others, I'd see what you think, it looks a little tricky if the government doesn't want a full inquiry and doesn't, you know, is trying to rush this through. It may be optics, it may be what you do for tax bills, you know, get the broad structure in first so people can't rot it before it comes in and then work it out. And I'm wondering what sense you have of the support for this inside the Labor caucus. Is there much pushback going on? Do either of you know? You're both down there.
Well, I think these are very Labor, quote-unquote, measures. And true. You have to see them in this context. They are, in large part, not entirely, but in large part, the shortened agenda of some elections ago. They're to the left or from the left of the Labor Party in ideological terms. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the government may judge that it has to just push to get them through. It doesn't want them watered down more than it has to water them down.
Yeah, there was a meeting of Labor MPs. Was reported in the Sydney Morning Herald. I've spoken to a couple of people about it too. It's, you know, where some concerns were raised. So there is a bit of dissent. It's not dissent to the whole idea, though. It's, again, to the area we're talking about, Michelle, like carve-outs, dealing with the panic of small business. So, of course, especially with a 94-seat majority, just to be clear about what that means, it means there are MPs covering constituencies that aren't necessarily always traditional Labor constituencies, more small business community. You know what I mean? So they've actually got, because they are such a dominant party now, a wider remit of representation. And a lot of, yeah, there are a lot of concerns in the community about how this will affect people. And so the Treasury is being kind of pressed on the exemptions case, although I think broadly most people think it's worth fighting for what they're doing.
Well, that would be my impression. And certainly there's not the sort of caucus revolt that we've seen in earlier years on various items.
In days past, Michelle, days past.
Days long past. It's a very different caucus from those days long past.
What about, I mean, we are seeing, and this is, again, age-old parliamentary tactics, a wedge and a counter-wedge going on here, aren't we, this week? You know, the government's linked this bill, the capital gains tax and negative gearing changes, to the payment of the WOTO, that's the $250 payment to income earners only. So that's linked. If you don't get this through, you don't get that $250. And now the opposition's talking about or hinting at holding up the NDIS reforms if the government doesn't agree to an inquiry into the CGT and negative gearing changes. So who's going to win the wedge?
Well, I think in terms of the wedge, firstly,
whose wedgie is going to be the most intense wedgie?
Who's got the best wedgie?
Firstly, I think it would be very foolish for the opposition to try to play off the NDIS reforms into this wider tax issue, because obviously we need to see those reforms. The opposition has made the argument that the NDIS is out of control, so it would be totally hypocritical. As for the tax wedge, well, yes, it's not all that good for the optics of the opposition voting against a tax cut in the name of the voting against the wider tax package. But I think we are in a different situation than before the election, when the opposition voted against those income tax cuts and was certainly wedged, was certainly in a very bad spot. I think that
Because it's only $250?
No, because it's 2 years out from an election. Yeah. And I think this issue will be somewhat submerged when we finally get to the election anyway, the opposition can argue that it has a plan for pretty drastic income tax relief. So you can see why the Treasurer is playing this game, and it might resonate with some people, but I don't think it'll have anything like the impact that it had in 2025.
Just some breaking news that an inquiry will be launched into Labor's tax changes. The Greens will send the government's tax changes to a Senate inquiry. You know, not probably the government's most ideal outcome here, but that's
Do we
politics.
Have a timeline for how long?
Oh, that's so Fran Kelly, you know, always on breakfast. Do I sound like I'm the leader of the Greens, Fran? I will have the Greens on afternoon briefing later and ask that question.
Oh, nicely handled, Pico, nicely handled.
Look, I want to do a big pivot into another theme of the week, which is quite different, but, you know, has been a big story this week. Another cohort of ISIS-linked women and children returned from Syria this week. That's 7 women and 12 children, all Australian citizens. No arrests were made, but the Home Affairs Secretary, Stephanie Foster, told Senate Estimates, and I quote, activities in law enforcement and intelligence agencies are ongoing, so that pressing charges remains under consideration. Now, Tony Burke told the House the police investigation was ongoing.
No one should presume that at any point in time the work of the Australian Federal Police in terms of investigating and gathering evidence is over.
Look, I've spoken to some people in government. They say it's just that they are in some ways very lucky. One lucky thing they got was that the first cohort, coincidentally, they don't organise these things, right, happened to be the ones where they were ready to press charges immediately. That probably helped them, because this second cohort, that hasn't happened straight away. So if you kind of swap this around, just sort of a bit of a thought project for you, and the cohorts were the other way around, you know, the women arriving, not being arrested would have been even a bigger political issue, because there is a discomfort around them coming back after they fought for or supported the fighting of ISIS. They joined that caliphate, that was a decision they made. You know, some people argue coercion. I think it's very complex. But either way, Michelle, these are people that many Australians are not comfortable with. And so it becomes a political issue for the government, because any government becomes responsible. How do you think it's played out? I feel like this second round, some of the heat has come out of it.
I think that's right, and that's probably because other issues, especially this whole budget argument, have taken some attention away. I think people's attitudes are probably baked in. Those who feel somehow these people should have been excluded, and others who think, well, they are Australian citizens, and even though a couple have been excluded on security grounds, we have to really accept the rest back here. It's a question now of monitoring. It's really over to the security agencies to see there are not problems with these so-called ISIS brides and their families, and that's going to be a long-term project.
But Michelle, I mean, I think, yes, you're both right that it's been quieter on the political front in a sense, because it's been drowned out by everything else. But I'm not sure. I think the optics that have been playing out over all the, you know, the news feeds that people are getting aren't good for the government, because I think people are discomforted by this, and the imagery of these women coming in and being met by, you know, the male supporters, one of whom in this latest lot, you know, pushed aggressively against a camera operator in the first lot. One of them abused a female journalist. You know, I think people don't like this. They don't like the look of this. It frightens people. And, you know, I think all it does is really all roads lead to One Nation and growing support for One Nation, which is what we're seeing. I think this feeds into it. Is it beholden, I think, on the government, state and federal, but also on the Muslim community to, you know, come out at this time and be openly reassuring of the Australian community? And certainly I think we've seen that the AFP have indicated, and all the police services are right across this, and I don't think we need to worry so much about that, the security angle. But I think it's the optics, and it feeds right into, you know, Pauline Hanson and her stance on Muslim immigration.
Well, I think that's probably right, but nevertheless, I do think the strong argument is these people had to be taken back.
It was just
too hard to do anything else. It was important the other day that the ones coming to New South Wales were whizzed away and you didn't get airport scenes. Now, there was some criticism that they were receiving special treatment, but I think that treatment was justified, and it did mean that there weren't clashes, and it minimised the optical problem of their return. But perhaps the more important issue, the greater attention should be focused on the hearings this week at the Anti-Semitism Royal Commission, where various security agencies appeared, and we got a bit of an insight into some of the lack of coordination between security agencies dealing with counter-terrorism, dealing with potential threats. And those sorts of gaps and problems are really important for the future and things that we need to see more focus on. A lot of information, of course, is being hidden because some of the hearings are in secret, but even from what we saw publicly, there are problems there to be rectified. So maybe those things are even more important than the actual issues around this cohort of so-called ISIS brides. Mm.
So in terms of the political ramifications, which I agree with Fran, all roads lead to One Nation on this issue, although I do believe some of the surging support for One Nation is so beyond this sort of concept of race politics. I think it's really,
I agree.
I really think it's a deep-rooted economic grievance, like this sort of compounding cost of living, you know, erosion of people's living standards that's made people overwhelmingly cranky. But speaking of One Nation, I mean, there's been this extraordinary polling in the AFR over the weekend, which Phil Curry teased on the podcast actually last week. We got a bit of a sneak peek there. The Redbridge MRP poll found if an election was held today under a worst case scenario for the major parties, One Nation would claim 59 seats, forcing Labor deep into minority government. Now, all the caveats are important here, right? Like, of course, we are way away from an election. All of these polling that goes, that's that wider, is deeply, can be, you know, should be kind of challenged, right? So all of that should be not criticising Redbridge per se, but, you know, broadly. However, I have spent, I'm in Canberra, I come for lots of the sitting weeks, as you know, Michelle. I've spent a lot of time trying to talk to people, and I will say that I feel that Liberal MPs are absolutely petrified. I'm not exaggerating. Like, they are like, they see this enormous train coming for them and they are worried. So all of them have different strategies. I'm doing this to try and inoculate myself. I'm going to use this, I'm the massive strategy. What I think is interesting about that is it's so seat by seat trying to protect people's own sort of sense of survival that you're almost like, I don't know, the cohesiveness of a party and thinking about winning a general election seems to even be going because it's like survivalist. Are you getting that vibe too?
I think there is a lot of fear, obviously, on the Conservative side about One Nation. I think people really don't know what to do. Yes, they can try and reinforce their support in their own seats, but if the giant wave is coming, it will take most of them before it. And, of course, that was the message from that poll. Mm. However, while we are 2 years away from a federal election, we're only months away from a Victorian election, and there's a New South Wales election in March. Now, I think both of these are big tests for One Nation. And One Nation is this giant balloon at the moment. More air was put into it by the Farrer by-election, but air can be taken out of it by the Victorian election and the New South Wales election, or more air can be put into it by those polls. Mm. So it faces tests also in coming months.
Yeah.
But at the moment, I think that It's an immediate threat to the coalition. It's a longer-term threat to Labor. I agree with the point you made that we're far beyond the old One Nation. It's now reflecting people's grievances on a massive scale, and it's not just about the cost of living, it's also their grievance about the party system, about the political system as a whole, their alienation from it, their feeling that the politicians don't really listen to ordinary people.
They just want to burn it down. That's what that Redbridge polling has told us. But Michelle, I guess the answer then for the Liberal Party is the answer. Here's a question for you. Is the answer Tony Abbott? He's about to be installed as the federal president of the Liberal Party. Is he the one to help get them into shape to prick that One Nation balloon?
Well, he's not the answer in that I don't think there's any one answer and maybe there's no answer.
Yeah. Well, you know what I'm saying, though. What do you think about the impact of his leadership here at this time on the Federal Liberal Party?
Well, I think it's a big gamble, to be honest. I think on the positive side, he has immense energy and he cuts through with a message. On the negative side, that message may be just too crude, as it were, too one-dimensional, and also he may be somewhat out of time. He's of a past set of liberal leaders rather than someone of the future. So there are pluses and minuses. I think it'll be an experiment that will be fascinating to watch.
Yeah, I think it'll be absolutely fascinating to watch. And yes, he knows how to run a sharp line. But I think some of the Abbott playbook, which is, you know, really campaign on what he would describe, he's, you know, a really bad Labor government, and just try and be really laser focused on that, repeat these very cutting lines. You can hear his own voice.
He's already doing it, isn't he, on lying, on dishonesty. He's already doing it.
You can hear it, his voice in Angus Taylor, right? You can hear Abbott. I always go on about it. I hear Abbott. I spent so much time with Abbott. I hear him. I hear his tone and his cadence, and he and the Liberal colleagues of theirs are saying this. But Angus Taylor is a different guy, and he can't just run the Tony Abbott playbook. He just, it doesn't work like that. You can't Temu someone. You have to do your own thing. And I think there might be an issue there. I also think, Michelle, Abbott is such a huge figure, such a giant of the Liberal Party, you know, like he literally, you know, destroyed a Labor government. Let's not forget, you know, he won heaps of seats in places like Victoria, apparently the Massachusetts of Australia. Like he knows how to campaign. He might overshadow Angus Taylor too, right?
I think that's the fear by a number of Liberals. Taylor is apparently very supportive of him as federal president, but certainly there's caution in Liberal ranks about this overshadowing. There's always caution in my mind too on another front. When Tony Abbott was first elected leader, I underestimated him dramatically. I thought I thought this was an incredibly high risk for the Liberal Party, so I reserve judgment.
Yeah, no, I think he's politically, yes, politically very capable and very astute. Michelle, I did note that you interviewed Keith Wallahan. He's a former Liberal. He got ousted at the last election. He was very highly regarded by his colleagues when he was in the Parliament. And you were talking to him about how he thinks the Liberals should face the One Nation threat. Now, he's in one of those urban seats that they've lost all over the country. What was his view on all of this?
I think this is interesting because it goes to this point about how One Nation and how it's regarded is now changed from years ago, because, of course, Keith Wallahan is a moderate and you would expect that he'd take a hard line on One Nation, but basically he takes a pragmatic attitude. He says that in terms of preferences, it should be a seat-by-seat matter.
This isn't an easy decision. It should be done on a seat-by-seat assessment, because sometimes whatever party someone is in, there are extraordinarily bad candidates with a terrible track record, and that should be assessed seat by seat. Politics is also about maths, and you have to recognise that while the Liberal Party, its mission is to defeat all other parties, including One Nation, it has to do that in a way that focuses primarily on forming a coalition majority. And so whatever the decision is, it has to be made with that in mind.
So that's just an example of how the Liberals really think about One Nation these days. I also think it's interesting that in what are terrible times for the Liberal Party, Keith Wallahan is very seriously thinking about running for Menzies again at the next election. So he's a brave man or a dedicated man or...
Yeah, one or the other. But he's also, he's got the fire in his belly, right? Like he, you know, if you are that passionate about going into politics and, you know, you and I have come across these characters for years, like it just, you can see it in Abbott actually wanting to be even the president.
Oh, absolutely. You can see it in Abbott.
Yeah, you can't give it up. It's just lives inside you. And I feel that way about Wallahan, and that's why he's going to take, I think, a substantial risk. Look, another risk, boom, boom, is... something that happened this week that then didn't happen, that maybe might happen but probably won't happen, but I'm not sure, Michelle, and that's a potential Teal party. Got raised. A couple of people are into it. Allegra Spender, Zali Steggall, other independents were like, oh, no. What's going on here?
And before you answer that, Michelle, can I just say that not being in Canberra, looking on from afar, this story sort of burst out like a shooting star and then sort of crashed to earth within moments, it felt like. Like, what was that all about?
Well, I think that it's about a couple of things. One is with the state of the Liberals, some centrist MPs and their backers think, well, there's a niche here for a centrist party leaning slightly to the right. And also, of course, with the new funding laws coming in for the next election, I think some of the Teals will feel somewhat under pressure because huge amounts have been spent in their campaigns, and the funding laws would limit the amount. They've always argued that these are unfair to independents, smaller parties, new entrants and so on, vis-a-vis the major parties. So money is a factor. I think that Zali Steggall in Tony Abbott's old electorate of Warringah is a sort of ringleader, if I can put it that way, in this,
I think you can.
This debate.
I'm in my third term, and after 7 years in Parliament, I can see how there are many things we could do politics better and differently. And I think a lot of people in the Australian public are really frustrated with the major parties. There's an inability from Labor to do the things people want to see, you know, tax on gas exports, truth in political advertising, gambling advertising reform. And on the other side, you have the coalition lurching to the right. They've now put Tony Abbott back in charge, and you see the rise of One Nation, and many are very, very worried about what that means for Australia, where we're heading as a country. So for me, I take that responsibility really seriously, that we have to keep evolving and looking at how do we best serve our communities.
I was surprised at Allegra Spender because I would have thought from her point of view, keeping herself really independent would be her best tactic. She's quite respected by the government. She was at the economic summit that they had. If she'd have been representing a small new party, I don't think she'd have got that invitation. And I do think there's a contradiction in terms, being a party of independence, if you like to put it that way, and that's recognised by some of the Teals. And also remember that the independents are not just Teals. There are community independents in the regions, people like Helen Haynes. She was very quick to say, I wouldn't be in such a movement. Mm-hmm. So was Rebecca
Most
Sharkey.
Most of them were, Michelle. Most of them were.
Yeah, so was Rebecca Sharkey over in Mayo in South Australia. So I think that the idea of some sort of centrist Teal party is unlikely to fly. Malcolm Turnbull's in favour, but perhaps that's not surprising.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's been in favour of a sort of, what is it, party of sensible people for years. And even he was downplaying any direct involvement in this particular plan. It just seemed to me a plot that was revealed and then but the politics around that were not well handled.
Don't forget, too, that actually putting a party together is a pretty difficult task.
It
involves setting up a whole branch structure, a lot
it,
of...
It involves naming a leader, Michelle.
Mm. Well, maybe they wouldn't have a leader. Maybe they really do want to do politics differently. But no, seriously, yes, a leader would be a problem.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, I think, you know, a few people said to me, you know, there's people obviously... You could hear what I'm about to say will reveal, you know, the sort of a level of bitchiness, if I can call it that. But, you know, other, you know, Allegra Spender, someone said to me, like, you know, she's been told she could be treasurer too many times, right? Like, you know, and she has been. If you read editorials and pieces, you know, she should be the treasurer in a Liberal government. Now, she doesn't want to be in the Liberal Party because the Liberal Party doesn't define all of her values anymore. So why not set up something else where one day you could be the treasurer, you know, like rather than what they're in now, which looks like it would be hard to form government.
You'd have to run down One Nation first, though, wouldn't you?
You know what? It's funny you mention that because that's one of the reasons she cites. That's one of the reasons they cite for why they even want to do this, that One Nation's on the rise, that they need something stronger to counter it.
Well, I don't think this would counter One Nation because I think that people who are attracted to One Nation would see the Teals probably as part of an elite. I think they're completely different constituencies.
So different, so different.
And Michelle, just before we go, let's talk about the NAC, that's the National Anti-Corruption Commission. The inaugural commissioner, Paul Brereton, stepped down from his role this week and immediately faced a Senate grilling.
I have become a distraction. Every time the chief executive officer comes up here, he has to answer questions about me. The press attention is focused on me and my interests. That is, the need to defend that has become a distraction, and that is basically why I have decided that it is in the interests of the organisation that I remove that distraction.
Do you accept any responsibility for that?
I think everyone contributes to their own downfall, if you like, in some ways, and I'm sure I have contributed to this in some ways.
And Helen Haynes, the community independent you just mentioned, she was the big driver for the NAC and for the legislation to set it up. And now she's saying, well, look, we need to do something quickly here to restore faith in this body, and they want it to be have an independent authority appointing the next commissioner rather than just the bipartisan parliamentary committee, which is what it is at the moment. Michelle, what do you think? Has this been very damaging to the Anti-Corruption Commission, or will it just sort of wash past most people? What do you think?
Well, it may wash past most people, but I do think this has been something of a disaster. The commissioner resigned saying that he had become a distraction because there have been controversies around him. They go to issues of conflicts of interest and have involved two inquiries by the inspector that oversees the NAC. And I think now you're hearing these calls for a, quote, reset, unquote, of the NAC. And I think this will involve not just the appointment of the commissioner, that process. And after all, a bipartisan or multipartisan committee did tick off on his appointment, on Brereton's appointment. So they have to blame themselves to some extent for all this. But I think the debate about the reset will also involve questions about whether there should be a wider provision for public hearings and various other issues. So it is very, very disappointing that the NAC in its first few years has been such a problem.
Yeah, making headlines for all the wrong reasons. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Look, just one more thing I just want to mention, because it's actually a really big deal. It's a story that's broken. We're not going to be able to talk about it at length to analyse it, but it's really worth mentioning. The Commonwealth is suing the manufacturer of the firefighting foam containing PFAS chemicals that have contaminated 28 defence bases across Australia. This is going to be, the Attorney General, Michelle Rowland, is up on her feet right now.
The Commonwealth is seeking more than $2 billion in damages.
to recover significant past and future expenses incurred, let me be clear, this is the largest legal claim ever brought by the Commonwealth.
Like, it's actually a really big deal that the government's launching this action. So just watch that space. So, yeah.
Well, it's impacted a lot of people's lives, you know, particularly if you think about the Indigenous community down there at Jervis Bay, had terrible impacts, health impacts on some communities. So I think, you know, the government will be congratulated for this.
It certainly will.
Michelle, thanks for being with us today. It's always great to have you on the Party Room. Thank you so much.
Really good to talk.
Taking time out on a very, very, very busy week.
Thanks, Michelle.
Bye-bye.
That's it for the Party Room today, but keep sending your questions in. We're going to do a special question time edition. Send them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Yeah, we do love those questions. And PK, David Spears is going to be back for Insiders on Background on Saturday, speaking to the godfather of Inland Rail. And then, of course, you're back Monday to Friday with Politics Now.
Yeah, that's right. And remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you never miss an episode, and also send it to five of your favourite people. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.